Well, one of the world's most remarkable artists could actually put his entire life's work on the tips of your fingers. You might say, well, wait a minute, how is that possible? Well, this guy named Nikolai, I can't even pronounce his last name, is what is called a micro-miniature sculptor. And what do micro-miniature sculptors create? Well, this guy actually poised three golden camels inside the eye of a needle. Along with that was a pyramid and a palm tree in the eye of a needle. It's kind of like, hey, I got a bunch of great art, but you got to have a microscope to see it, right? He has inserted a flea-sized red rose inside a hollowed-out human hair. And on the flat edge of a cut human hair, he has balanced two tiny working padlocks. That's his claim. Complete with keys. He's copied 600-note musical scores on leaves the size of a grain of rice. And micro-miniature artists have to overcome some huge barriers. And of course, all of us are going to go Google this as soon as church is out today, I'm sure. But the problem that they have to overcome is that one sneeze, one cough, one blow from an air conditioner, and you lose it all. You'll never find it. I mean, it's so small, right? And he even said that, static electricity is one of the biggest problems with a micro-miniature sculptor. And he says, the spark that comes when you walk on the rug in winter, you touch something. He says, when I was working on an Oasis scene, I lost two camels because of static electricity. An electrical surge, he said, is like a giant catastrophe for these miniature sculptors. And I was like, man, that's so cool. I want to go see more of these things. But, the thing is, there's only like five micro-miniature sculptors in the entire earth, at least at the point this was written. Maybe there's more now. But, how difficult it is to work with those little things. I mean, it's kind of an amazing thing to even think about. But switching gears a little bit, it's through God's perfect control that He has, that He's able to control much smaller things all throughout the universe. And it's a great example of His awesome power and His ability and how big God is. God is so much bigger and infinite than we as people, and yet He cares enough to inject Himself into human history and sometimes lovingly discipline us. God in His immense, infinite self injects Himself into human history. And here in chapter 15 through 23, we see God judging the nations that surrounded the southern kingdom of Judah and even Judah itself. A lot of times when it comes to judgment, a lot of people say, well, man, this is really hard. How can God be loving and yet be judging and casting, this destruction over certain nations? And the truth is that because God is fair and just, He also has to exercise judgment and discipline. And of course, the Bible tells us that, He loves those whom He chastens. And today, as we study through chapter 15 through 23, or sort of 1,000 feet up, we're going to observe the son of Amos pointing out that God is greater than the nations. Pause for a second and consider that many of the nations that surrounded Judah and Israel, remember Judah was to the south, the northern kingdom was called Israel, and they were worse than the southern kingdom. They get destroyed before the south, and there were many kingdoms that were approaching them, and Assyria was this incredible army from the east that would come and destroy the northern kingdom and destroy many of the kingdoms surrounding. And then, of course, Assyria would be overcome by the Babylonians. And then the Babylonians, that world empire, would be overcome by the Medo-Persian Empire. And then after that, it's the Romans. And we've talked about this before, but it's interesting to consider that Isaiah is speaking to the people of Judah about all the nations that surrounded them that, let's just be honest, a lot of them made fun of the God of Israel. They mocked the temple. They mocked this one God when they had many gods. And ultimately, God was going to cast some judgment and deal with these nations, many of which were actually enemies of the southern kingdom of Judah. And so we're seeing, in simple part, God is greater than these nations. And as we go through this, a couple of them will pop up on the screen above me, and then we'll go through it and talk about one chapter at a time or one section at a time. And remember, when it comes to the book of Isaiah, one of the most important things to understand as we think about this chapter, this 66-chapter book, is it breaks into two parts. The first part is God's, well, His retribution, His disciplining work that He's doing in the south and to the people of Israel. And then in chapter 40 through 46, or excuse me, through 66, well, that's God's restoring work. And throughout this book, there's incredible information about the Messiah Jesus and His first coming. And even next week, as we get into chapter 24 to 27, about Jesus' second coming and the kind of things that will happen on the earth before He returns. But these two parts make up the book of Isaiah. And as we zeroed in and started a while back in chapter 13, well, chapter 13, like I said, goes all the way to chapter 23. And instead of us taking all 10 chapters on a Sunday, I only decided to do 8. I wanted to talk about 13 and 14. But as we move into these chapters, what we're seeing here is important to highlight because Isaiah had these burdens that he was sharing with each nation. And some of you take notes. You're going to see at the beginning of many of these chapters the burden for this nation, the burden for that nation. And that's where the breakdown comes. And so it's important to understand, as it started in chapter 13, verse 1, and in chapter 14 and 15, and it continues on, that these burdens, the Hebrew word means to lift up. The prophet was actually carrying a heavy weight. This burden that he was sharing was a very serious and solemn message, and most of it had to do with destruction. He was announcing that there would be judgments upon these nations and even upon the people of Judah themselves, and he felt burdened by it. He had this heavy information on his heart to share. And as he speaks these things to the people of Judah about the future and how these kingdoms would be dealt with, guess what? Everything that he said happened. But it's interesting to see that way before they did take place, Isaiah was telling and prophesying about this. And so really, for the next 8 chapters, what we're observing, if we were to look at it as a whole, these 8 chapters, is God's sovereignty over corrupt human governments. You know that God is still sovereign today. Even over bad governments and places and people that are in power, God allows things for certain reasons. And the only real fix is going to be when Jesus comes back. And I think we'll all be glad then. But he's even going to talk about his dealings with Judah and Israel, and that they're included in this is a very interesting thing. And so first, we see the nation of Moab. And this is where we'll look at chapters 15 and 16 and kind of highlight some verses as we move through this. But in chapter 15, it starts off this way. Verse 1 of chapter 15 says, "The burden against Moab. Because in the night, Ar of Moab is laid waste and destroyed. Because in the night, Kir of Moab is laid waste and destroyed. He has gone up to the temple and Dibon to the high places to weep. Moab will wail over Nebo and over Medeba. On all their heads will be baldness and every beard cut off. In their streets they will clothe themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses and in their streets, everyone will wail, weeping bitterly." You might say, wow, that sounds pretty serious. They were pretty bummed out. Well, the reason why they were being judged, this place called Moab, is actually found in the next chapter, 16. And I want you to notice verse 6. And this is where we observe really kind of the reason for all this. And Isaiah says, "We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so." And so later on in chapter 16, it becomes very clear, and I want you to notice how clear Isaiah made it about the people of Moab. "But now the Lord has spoken," he says in chapter 16, verse 14. "Now the Lord has spoken, saying, 'Within 3 years, as the years of a hired man, the glory of Moab will be despised with all that great multitude, and the remnant will be very small and feeble.'" And so the people of Moab were going to be judged. And if you're taking notes, you need to write this down, and we'll do this with each one of these nations. What was the problem with Moab? Why was God judging this nation? Well, Moab, listen, was guilty of extreme pride. Pride was something Well, the Bible tells us a lot about pride, but one very important verse tells us that God resists the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. Proverbs tells us that pride comes before a fall. And when you have a proud person, you have them in a dangerous place because they're either thinking they're the best or the worst. Either way, they're concerned with only themselves. But when you have a nation that's proud, bad things happen. They become self-confident and overconfident, have a lot of blind spots. But the Moabites, you might say, well, who were these guys? We don't really, you know a lot about the Moabites. We haven't really talked about them a whole lot. But the Moabites were the product of Lot's incestuous union with his daughter. And it's kind of a very shocking reality. But if you read Genesis chapter 19, you'll see the story. But here's what you really need to understand. The Moabites were bitter enemies of the Jewish people. And so as God pronounces these judgments, He starts with many of these nations that were enemies to the people of Israel. And God was going to deal with them. The Moabites resided in kind of the southeast of the Dead Sea. And this was a large grassy plateau that was filled with all kinds of grazing animals. And because you have a bunch of grazing animals, you have a whole bunch of the necessities of life, like cheese, butter. You have things that they're going to make because of those, you know, animals. And so the Moabites were actually, you know, followed many false gods, and they didn't believe in the God of Israel. And they were sort of secluded. And when the Assyrian Empire comes to destroy the northern alliance of Syria and Israel, well, they're going to wipe out many of these other smaller nations as well. And the Moabites would definitely be wiped out as well. You know, at times, the Moabites were incredibly hostile towards the nation of Israel. It was actually Balak, the king of Moab, that hired Balaam the prophet. And maybe you remember the talking donkey story. That's the one, Numbers 22 through 25. You can go and check it out. But, you know, he hired this prophet to curse Israel. And it was Eglon, the king of Moab, another king of these Moabites, who oppressed Israel in the days of the judges. You can read Judges chapter 3. And even during the time of Saul and David, this was before, you know, all of this was taking place, Saul and David, they had a pretty firm control over the Moabites because the kingdoms were strong. But when the kingdom became weak, well, the Moabites became stronger, they became more of a problem. And so the problem that the Moabites were facing really is found there in verse 15. And simply put, to make it easier to track with me and what I'm saying, the Moabites' problem was that they were about to be invaded by the Assyrians. And here's the shocking thing. They were about to be invaded by an enemy that they had no chance of even defending themselves against. And instead of them getting help from the people of Judah and going to Jerusalem and being refugees, because they were so proud, and because they didn't believe in the God of Judah, or the God of Israel, we might say, they would not submit themselves to the people of Judah. In other words, their pride made them say, we're too good to submit to just this one God that these people worship. We're going to take our chances and try to deal with these guys ourselves. And guess what happened? They got wiped out. It was their pride that ultimately led to their undoing. And you know, they fled to their temples, they prayed to their gods, according to chapter 15, verse 2. But guess what? It didn't help them. Why? Because they were praying to gods that don't exist. And ultimately, God wanted to bring judgment upon these people to cause them to recognize that they were proud and that they needed to be humble. But of course, they were going to be overtaken by the great nation of Assyria. Well, these Moabites and their pride and the harboring of the pride in their hearts is really why I read chapter 16, verse 6. And, you know, we might think, well, why are the Moabites so proud? Notice it says there in verse 6, it kind of tells us that we've heard of the pride of Moab. You know, where they have a bunch of tall buildings, they have a bunch of fat cattle, or what was it that they were so proud of? I mean, we could think about the nation of Babylon. Remember, we've talked about their huge walls and wonderful architecture and things where you might say, yeah, I'm from Babylon, look at how beautiful this place is. What were these Moabites proud about? And you might ask that question. Well, their pride was more about their culture and their animosity towards Israel and their many gods. And they ultimately would be trampled. and you know their land would reduce to rubble. And it's interesting because even in the midst of Isaiah talking about an enemy of Israel, Moab, Isaiah shows his own grief towards the news in verses 9 through 11 in chapter 16. And isn't it interesting that even though Moab was an enemy, Isaiah still showed grief that they would be destroyed like that? And what does that show us? Well, that shows God's heart, is that God wasn't happy that people were being destroyed, but it was something that was going to happen because of this army that God was allowing to come in. A lot of times we wonder why God allows certain things. And you might say, man, I think this is wrong. Why did this have to happen? Why did this happen? And yes, there's evil in the world, but many times God will use what was used for evil to do good. And we don't understand all of his purposes because he sees so much more, because he's so much bigger and vast than we are. It's as if we're one of those little camels in the eye of the needle saying, I've got it all figured out. But we only see a very small portion of the whole. But God sees the whole. What makes Moab's pride so completely crazy is that they would rather take their chances in running from a merciless enemy that would pursue them to no end than put themselves under the God of Judah. And this is where we draw our lesson from. Pride kept them from submitting to the truth and to the true and living God. And so the Moabites, Isaiah looks at them with astonishment of their pride. That's why he says how proud he is, how we've heard of their pride. Isaiah heaps words upon words to describe how prideful they were. And let me put it to you in simple modern terms. They had such a national ego that they were unwilling to say, we're weak and we need help from these guys. You know, some of us have watched dearly loved family members on their deathbeds who are basically clinging in defiance to not believing in God or trusting in the gospel of Christ that, you know, just absolutely refuse. You know, there's this evil part of our hearts that's corrupted by sin that really is sort of bent on doing everything but bowing to the Lord. And that's kind of the attitude that these Moabites had. And let me just simply say that pride will cause us to resist the call of God and the help of God. Pride will always, well, cause destruction. But many times, in throughout the Scriptures, pay attention, this is important. Prideful nations, prideful people, guess what? They don't last long. It's just the truth that the Bible proclaims. Now, when I say that, that's kind of scary, isn't it? Well, the reason why is because our culture sort of tells us to be prideful people, to be focused on ourselves, to be thinking about self. And it's dangerous. Pride is dangerous. And ultimately, this is what led to the destruction of the Moabites. And so the advice that I would give and the thought that I think of when I think about the Moabites in chapters 15 and 16 is that we need to be people that are humble before God and recognize that ultimately God is the best. He is the greatest. He knows everything. He is our source of strength, the one we turn to. And so ultimately, the Moabites, even though they had security at different times, they would be wiped out. And God tells the people of Judah through the prophet Isaiah. And now he goes on in chapter 17 to talk about something even more interesting. And in chapter 17, we're seeing the nations of Syria and Israel. Remember, Israel was to the north, 10 tribes to the north that had broke away from the southern kingdom. They were grossly practicing idolatry. They lined themselves up with the Syrians and had formed an alliance to defend themselves against Assyria, which was off to the east, this very large, dangerous nation that was wanting to conquer the world. And so they hooked up Syria and Israel and formed an alliance. And I want you to listen to some of chapter 17, looking specifically at verses 1 through 3, as Isaiah says, the burden against Damascus. Behold, Damascus will cease from being a city, and it will be a ruinous heap. The cities of Oer are forsaken, and they will be for flocks which lie down, and no one will make them afraid. The fortress also will cease from Ephraim, the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria, and they will be as the glory of the children of Israel, says the Lord of hosts. So identify the fact there, you see the word Damascus, and you see the word Ephraim. Damascus is another word for Syria. It was their capital city. And Ephraim is another word for Israel to the north, the northern kingdom. So interchangeably throughout the book of Isaiah, sometimes they'll use different terms, Isaiah will, in referring to those nations. And so Syria and Israel, listen, write this down, were both guilty of doing something that they had in common. They were both guilty of trusting in false gods. And notice, having said that, I want you to pay attention to also in 17, notice verses 7 through 9, or excuse me, 7 through 10, notice what Isaiah says. He's speaking to the people of Judah about the northern kingdom, and he says, in that day a man will look to his maker, and his eyes will have respect for the Holy One of Israel. And he will not look to the altars, the work of his hands. He will not respect what his fingers have made, nor the wooden images, nor the incense altars. In that day his strong cities will be as a forsaken bow, and an uppermost branch which they left because of the children of Israel, and there will be desolation. But verse 10 is very important. He says, because you have forgotten the God of your salvation. And so he tells them there that they forgot about the God of their salvation. They had many false gods. And see, this is an interesting just dynamic in this little alliance that they had going. The Israelites were very foolish because they trusted in their man-made idols more than the true and the living God, more than the God who parted the Red Sea, who led the people out of the wilderness. I mean, there was all these things that God showed up and revealed himself, and yet they were believing in gods that they created, those wooden images, those incense altars and things. They had all of these false gods that they were focused on. But like Israel long ago, even people today trust in gods that they've made with their own hands. Surprisingly, there are actually many false gods in our culture, too many to talk about, but let me just highlight several that have really permeated our society to the core. Money and wealth have become idols, have become false gods. Human knowledge has become an idol, that so much so that people can be educated beyond their own intelligence and have information that's completely useless, but because it's human knowledge, wow! Human knowledge, and then, of course, popularity and fame. Those are false gods. But I would say the most common false god among our society and the world today is the god of self. People who worship themselves. This is an interesting thing, because I want you to pause for a second and let me get your attention. Syria and Israel had teamed up, and you know why? Because they both practiced idolatry. And what happens over time for us as believers is if we get away from God, we can start adopting things that are poisonous to our lives and even dangerous, but it really doesn't sometimes become obvious until it's too late. And that's exactly what happened to the northern kingdom. They started to practice idolatry, they had false gods, they turned away from the true and living God, and then they started making alliances with people that had those same values. And this is where we really draw our lesson from, because the most telling thing about this chapter is the idea of who do we really align ourselves with. See, if we align ourselves with people that do not believe in God or follow His ways, it's very likely that we're going to do that very same thing. And so the people of Israel had grown distant from the truth. They embraced the ways of those around them, like the Syrians, and pretty soon they were hanging out and they were sort of in cahoots, if you will. They were together to try to fight off the Assyrians. You know, in the New Testament, there's a great verse, and I want you to write it down because it has a lot to do with this subject. In 1 Corinthians 15:33, this is what it says. 1 Corinthians 15:33, I'm going to read it to you, but listen to what Paul said to the Corinthians who had aligned themselves with people that had wrong beliefs as well. Listen, do not be deceived, Paul says. Evil company corrupts good habits. See, Paul was actually speaking to the Corinthians about how they had gotten hanging out with people that didn't believe in proper things about God or the resurrection. And ultimately, they had allowed themselves to sort of be corrupted. And Paul actually quotes that phrase, evil company corrupts good habits, is not from the Old Testament. It's not from Jesus. It was actually said by this pagan named Menander in a play that he wrote called Theus. And so, believe it or not, Paul is quoting a pagan, but by the ministry of the Holy Spirit, this was something that, even though it was said by a pagan, was still true. And it's still in the Bible, because doesn't that make sense? Well, it lines up with many other things. Perhaps you've heard me refer to the Proverbs that say, he who walks with wise men will be wise, but the company of fools brings destruction. Or perhaps you've maybe heard me say that the righteous should choose their friends carefully, because the way of the wicked leads them astray. And this is exactly what was wrong with the people of Israel in the north. This tribe had turned away from God. They had aligned themselves with people that didn't believe in the true and living God, and it caused them to go further and further away from God's will. Sound familiar? You know, if we're not careful, we can get led in wrong directions from people that may be well-meaning and they may really care about us, but if they don't know the Lord or walk in the will and the Word of God, we can get led down wrong paths. And it happens a lot. And so those two nations, or two places, Moab and Syria and Israel, their little alliance. And now we get into the third, which is chapter 18, which is the burden for Ethiopia. Look at verse 1 through 2, just 1 and 2 there in chapter 18, as Isaiah says, "Woe to the land shadowed with buzzing wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, which sends ambassadors by sea, even in vessels of reed on waters, saying, 'Go, swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth of skin, to a people terrible from their beginning onward, a nation powerful and treading down, whose land the rivers divide.'" Basically, pay attention for a second and understand, Isaiah is talking about the nation of Ethiopia sending out people who are basically diplomats to find powerful allies on the other side of the rivers. Terrible and mighty people. In other words, they said, hey, we got to send out some diplomats to make alliances with all of these other nations who were strong so that we can be safe from the Assyrians. As that army approached the people of Israel and all of these nations surrounding the southern kingdom of Judah, well, there were many nations that sort of, you know, panicked and started to send out as many people as they could. And so here's the idea. Ethiopia, or what it was commonly called in Isaiah's day, Cush, was guilty of idolizing diplomacy. But let me put it to you even in more simple terms. Ethiopia was guilty of idolizing man-made resolve. It was this idea of, we can figure it out, we can fix this, we can find other people that we can align with, and we can deal with the situation. Now, there's nothing wrong with diplomacy or man-made resolve, but it's wrong whenever we don't depend on God as the foundation. Whenever we want to run a government where God's been thrown out, where do we draw the line with what's right and wrong? How do we make decisions? When it comes to man-made resolve and trying to figure things out, we need God to give us wisdom, and that needs to be the basis. And so perhaps you understand where I'm going, but to be clear, the biblical Ethiopia should not be confused with the modern nation that has the same name. Even though it did include the modern nation of Ethiopia, what we need to understand is that in this day and age, Ethiopia covered what we would see on the map today in northern Africa as Ethiopia, but also covered the Sudan and Somalia. So it's a much larger area. And it was commonly called Nubia. And there were these people that mimicked the pharaohs of Egypt. They had their own pharaohs. I was sort of surprised to find out that when Egypt sort of waned in its power, the Ethiopians had Ethiopian pharaohs. And they would, you know, try to rule in sort of the same way that the Egyptians did. And, of course, Ethiopia was going to get wiped out and going to be dealt with. And these, of course, were at one point in time enemies of Israel in certain times in certain ways. And notice it says there in verse 1, the land of whirling wings. I think it's how it's communicated in the New King James or the NIV, buzzing wings. But not only because of the insects that infested the land, there were apparently a lot of bugs. but also because the idea of the buzzing of the diplomats going out to try to find help, you know, sort of a play on words there. But they were trying to find these alliances. And so let me just say this, as we think about Ethiopia, as we think about this nation that God is going to judge and allow to be destroyed, I think there's a lesson there, because there's always a danger in trusting man's ability to resolve things rather than trusting in God. There's always a danger in trusting in government alone rather than in trusting God. And following His word, seeking Him in prayer, and then getting our solutions from Him. That's how things really work. And so there's a lesson there. There's a great lesson as we overview this chapter. We need to be careful that we always understand that governments, societies really only operate correctly whenever God is the one that's in charge. One day, and of course, this is why Isaiah is communicating this, because as we get to chapter 24 through 27, it's the time before the Messiah comes back, when He'll be the one that rules and reigns from Jerusalem. We've talked about that. But now, it goes from Ethiopia to sort of talking about those that were directly to the west, the Egyptians, which most of us are familiar with where Egypt is on the map. But I want you to notice chapters 19 and 20, as we see here this burden in verse 1 of chapter 19, the burden against Egypt. Behold, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. The idols of Egypt will totter at His presence, and the heart of Egypt will melt in its midst. These Egyptians were very powerful and lived very extravagant lives, and yet they were going to be so scared of the Assyrians that they would be shaking in their boots, if you will. They would be totally afraid. And Egypt, according to chapters 19 and 20, they were guilty of two things: sorcery and extravagance. Sorcery is something that I'll define more later on, but these guys practice a lot of magic. Perhaps you remember when Moses was taking the people out of Egypt that he performed miracles. And if you read the account in Exodus, it tells us that the Pharaoh's magicians mimicked the miracles of Moses, but they couldn't undo them. And so apparently there is a demonic presence that is able to mimic things, but not necessarily undo things. And this is what was going on with their sorcery and their incantations and all of their books of magic. And they were guilty of sorcery, but also extravagance. And the Lord strikes Egypt by giving them over to civil war, according to these chapters, and ultimately having to be dealt with by a cruel master, the king of Assyria. And so, of course, some believe this was actually fulfilled in 670 BC, when Egypt was conquered by Esarhaddon, which was the then king of Assyria. And really, that's not as important as understanding, just simply, that God was going to judge Egypt. And that earlier on, pause for a second and remember, the king of Judah was going to try to align himself, Ahaz. Others were going to try to align themselves with, you know, Egypt and other places. There were people saying, hey, let's connect with them. But ultimately, they got destroyed as well, so it wouldn't have done them any good. And many people were saying to the southern kingdom of Judah, we need the Egyptians, let's team up with those guys. And of course, then they decided, let's team up with the Assyrians, because they're the invading army. But they ended up destroying, or trying to destroy them anyways. All of that to say, chapter 20 is a fascinating chapter. And notice what it says. It's kind of a side note to the prophecy against Egypt that's found there in chapter 19. But I want to read you all of chapter 20 and notice what it says. In the year that Tartan came to Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him, and he fought against Ashdod and took it, at the same time the Lord spoke by Isaiah the son of Amos, saying, go and remove the sackcloth from your body and take your sandals off your feet. And he did so, walking naked and barefoot. And then the Lord said, just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot 3 years for a sign and a wonder against Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians as prisoners and the Ethiopians as captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. Then they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and Egypt, their glory. And the inhabitant of this territory will say in that day, surely such is our expectation, wherever we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria, and how shall we escape? The language is a little bit hard to understand, but when you read this, what it tells us is something very shocking. Isaiah, up until this time before Egypt is actually taken captive, would wear an outer, would take off his outer garment, his sackcloth, which was a sign of grieving, clothes of mourning. And God tells him, remove all of that and take off your sandals too. And then you'll notice that phrase, and he did so walking naked and barefoot. And you might kind of be shocked, wait a minute, Isaiah walked around naked for 3 years? That's kind of crazy. Well, naked in this day and age is different than the naked we might say today. Because we shouldn't think of Isaiah as totally nude. He would have been completely without his outer garments. And instead he wore his inner garment, which, you know, could have been like wearing a t-shirt and night shorts or underwear, if you will. But that's what he walked around in for 3 years as a sign to the people of Judah that this is what would happen to the Egyptians. Keep in mind, there's people saying, we should hook up with the Egyptians, they can protect us. And Isaiah's walking around saying, no, this is what they're going to look like. You know, throughout the Bible, there's all these crazy ways that God asks people, his prophets, to do illustrated ways of communication. And we'll see more of this and even talk more about examples. We don't have time today, but he does all of this and ultimately shows that the people were going to suffer, and those that lived extravagant, that practiced all this magic, would ultimately be prisoners walking around in their nightclothes, suffering. And this is what was to be ahead, and it happened exactly like he said. There's two ways to think about sorcery, and two ways I always like to point out. Sorcery is drug use, but then what is commonly not understood is superstition. There are a lot of things that sort of line up with sorcery that way. Sorcery is obviously the practice of magic, but then there's altering your mind through the use of drugs. This is the kind of things that God forbids in the New Testament and even says is bad in the Old Testament. But one way that sorcery comes out in our culture today is through superstition. Many people believe in that if I do this way, this will happen. You know, if I save this piece of paper, if I read this fortune, if I read this horoscope, there's all this superstition out there. People think, oh no, you better knock on wood before you do this, or you got to touch the top of your ceiling when you go over railroad tracks, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff. And superstition is something that is not of God, because there's no such thing as superstition, because God is ultimately in charge. And both of these lead us away from following God's word and his will. And the Egyptians are sort of an example for us. Like, be careful, because sorcery and extravagance can be dangerous to a society. And for us, we can sort of draw from that and say, you know, as Americans, this is important for us to not be superstitious, but to be spiritual and know the true and living God and be born again. Well, number five is very brief, because Isaiah's already spent a lot of time talking about the nation of Babylon and how it would be judged. Pause for a second and consider that Babylon came around in its power and might after Assyria. So right now, Assyria is coming up and is this incredible army that's going to destroy a lot of people. And Babylon was simply one of the places that Assyria would conquer before it would go somewhere else. Now later on, it sort of flips. Babylon, instead of it just being a city, becomes an empire. But the Assyrians would first conquer Babylon, and this is what is talked about in chapter 21, verses 1 through 10. Now, I'm not going to read those, but simply want to point out that Isaiah says in chapter 21, verses 9 and 10, he says, "And look, here comes a chariot of men with a pair of horsemen." And then he answered and said, "Babylon is fallen, and all the carved images of her gods he has broken to the ground. Oh, my threshing and the grain of my floor, that which I have heard from the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, I have declared to you." So Babylon would be conquered by the Assyrians. And here's the thing about Babylon that we've already talked about before, but it is good to highlight. Babylon was guilty of extreme idol worship and paganism. And God was going to deal with them, but then turn around and use them to actually conquer the southern kingdom. Because remember, after Assyria, when Babylon becomes an empire, it's Nebuchadnezzar that actually takes the southern kingdom captive, takes them off to captivity. But before that, they would be conquered by the Assyrians. I don't know about you, but as you start going through this, you start to realize that they're not hearing any good news. You know, they're hearing from Isaiah that everybody's going to fall. Everybody's going to be defeated. And it really kind of puts you in the place of, what if someone told you that everything in your life was going to be taken away? It would show you just how much your hope is either in God or in your stuff. Have you ever thought about that? Like, what if everything was taken away? Would I be content? Some of us don't have a lot, so it doesn't really matter. But, you know, it's like you get to places where you have more things, more relationship, more friends. But it's like, ultimately, we need to be content with just having the Lord. And all those other things are great. There's nothing wrong with having a nice house or a car or those kind of things. But those are extras. It's God that we really need. And so Babylon was guilty of all this idolatry and paganism. But then Isaiah goes on in verses 11 and 12. I'll talk about this whole nation. Number 6 is Edom. You might say, what is Edom? And I don't understand. Well, look at what verses 11 and 12 say there in chapter 21. "The burden against Duma. He calls to me out of Seir. Watchmen, what of the night? Watchmen, what of the night? The watchman said, 'The morning comes and also the night. If you will inquire, return, come back.'" So you clearly see the burden against Duma. And you might say, well, what does Duma have to do with Edom? Listen, let me get your attention. Duma and Seir, that S-E-I-R city, those were actually names that they used for Edom, or the Edomites. And the Edomites were descendants of Esau. Remember the hairy guy that was Jacob's brother that he stole the birthright from? His name, Esau, meant red, so he was apparently either he had red hair or he was just covered in red dirt. And there's kind of debate, I guess, about that. But, you know, he was the guy that started the whole Edom kingdom or nation. And of course, they were actually regarded as brothers to Israel because Esau was Jacob's brother, but they were also enemies of Israel, and they didn't really believe in the things that the Israelites believed in. And so Isaiah is describing himself here as the watchman on the wall, and he asks that question, what of the night? The advance of that Assyrian army, well, had brought fearful darkness to all the nations that were sort of watching this cloud of soldiers come at them. And Edom wanted to know if there was any hope, any light. And the prophet's reply here makes it very clear that they weren't going to have any hope, that they were going to be overcome. They were going to be conquered. And they would be defeated. And ultimately, the Edomites end up vanishing from the complete historical scene in AD 70 after the Romans. But here's what you got to know. Edom was this place that would be judged, this nation. If you look on a map of the just the kingdom of Israel and Judah during the time of Isaiah, you'll see Edom to the south, directly to the south. And they would ultimately be judged. And so what you see God doing is saying, look guys, all the nations around you that have made fun of you, come against you, I'm going to deal with all of them. But then we sort of go next to, after he says that, but I'm going to also deal with you guys. And this is the scary part. In chapter 22, we see that Judah and Jerusalem, really we could just say Judah, was going to be judged. And if you look back at chapter 21 before we go on to chapter 22. There was Edom and then there was Arabia in chapter 21, verses 13 through 17. And those guys were guilty of pomp and self-glory. These Arabs that lived out as sort of nomads ultimately would be so overcome by the Assyrians that they would, you know, be asking for water and help. And so all of these kingdoms, all of these people that surrounded the nation of Israel and the southern kingdom were ultimately going to come under just the oppression of the Assyrian army. And so all of these armies, all this army would come against Babylon, would come against Edom, would come against Arabia, but then ultimately Judah and Jerusalem would be judged at one point. And this is when the Babylonians would come. But look at chapter 22. And I want you to notice verses 8 through 11. And this is the way to summarize this and see what God is saying through Isaiah to these people. He says, Isaiah says, "He removed the protection of Judah. You looked in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. You also saw the damage to the city of David, that it was great. And you gathered together the waters of the lower pool. You numbered the houses of Jerusalem and the houses you broke down to fortify the wall. You also made a reservoir between the two walls for the water of the old pool." But this is the most important part that God says through Isaiah. "But you did not look to its maker, nor did you have respect for him who fashioned it long ago." This is an interesting thing because Judah was guilty ultimately of not giving God their all. They had mixed loyalties. They did everything to try to protect themselves against Assyria and against Babylon, but they didn't trust God. And the truth was, the people of Judah were behaving like their pagan neighbors, and so it was only right that Isaiah should include them in the list of nations that God was going to deal with. There were two sins that Judah was guilty of, and it's real simple to understand. Number one, they were guilty of unbelief. And that's kind of what Isaiah talks about in chapter 22, verses 1 through 14, is their unbelief. They didn't believe God. They didn't trust God. They did everything but trust the Lord. But then they also were unfaithful. And that's in chapter 22, verses 15 through 25. And here's the simple way that Isaiah illustrates that. Isaiah starts talking about one of the leaders, pay attention, that was a treasurer, that not only were the people unbelieving, but then the leaders were unfaithful. We've seen this before in other studies. We've talked about it, about Judah. But what's crazy is that Isaiah just totally busts this guy named Shebna, who was apparently a treasurer to King Hezekiah. Instead of this guy using the money that he was responsible for from the king to actually take care of the kingdom and the king, he went and built stuff for himself. He neglected the people but took care of himself. And I can't help but when I see this to recognize that, and this is very rarely will you hear me have anything to say about politics, but when it comes to city government, the things that just bother me the most are that, you know, mayors, city councils, and people that have desk jobs are getting all these raises and all these things and promotions, while the people that clean up the trash and do all the hard work are overworked and underpaid. And of course, if we learn from this principle, we would learn that, you know, a public servant is someone that's there to serve the people, not themselves. But that's exactly what was going on in Israel. The politicians, the people that were supposed to be responsible with the money, they were using it for themselves. And God totally busts this guy, Shebna. I always wonder what this guy thought about him being mentioned by name. Isaiah prophesies about his misuse of funds. And so ultimately, unbelief and unfaithfulness led to what I think ultimately is the conclusion of those things, selfishness. That unbelief and unfaithfulness lead us to selfishness. They perpetuate selfishness in our lives. We don't believe God, and we're not faithful with what He commits to us to be stewards over. And so Judah would be judged. Judah was going to have to be taken captive by the Babylonians. God wasn't done with His people. Remember, because they violated the Mosaic covenant, which was God's law, they were going to be disciplined, but they were never going to be taken out of the Abrahamic covenant, that covenant with Abraham that they would always be God's people and always be blessed. God was going to discipline them because of their unfaithfulness and unbelief in following God's word. You know, as we get to the last one here, number 9, chapter 23 is one of those chapters that you might not understand it right away, but in chapter 23, verses 1 through 5, listen to what it says. The burden against Tyre, wail, you ships of Tarshish, for it is laid waste, so that there is no house, no harbor. From the land of Cyprus it is revealed to them. Be still, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon, whom those who cross the sea have filled. On great waters, the grain of Shehor, the harvest of the river is her revenue, and she is a marketplace for the nations. Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea has spoken. The strength of the sea is saying, I do not labor, nor bring forth children, neither do I rear young men, nor bring up virgins. When the report reaches Egypt, they also will be in agony at the report of Tyre. Now, when you think about Tyre and Sidon, pay attention. Those were key cities in Phoenicia. That was the nation. The nation of Phoenicia had two major cities, and that was Tyre and Sidon. And those places were on the coast. And they were places that became a hub for trade, for commerce. So not only were those people in Tyre and Sidon wealthy, but it also tells us that there was no harbor. It refers to, in this chapter, the ships. They had an incredibly powerful navy, and they had a lot of money. And a powerful navy and a shipping port, people were very, very comfortable, very wealthy. Of course, this would be what we would call today modern-day Lebanon. So you can look on a map and kind of see where Tyre and Sidon actually were. You know, both David and Solomon used workers from Phoenicia. You'll find that in 2 Samuel and in 1 Kings. Maybe you're even familiar with King Ahab, how he married a Phoenician princess named Jezebel. Some of us have heard that name before. But those that lived in Tyre and Sidon actually worshipped Baal. Or Baal, if you want to call him that. B-A-A-L. They worshiped this false god. And so they had all kinds of idol worship. And the happy, wealthy citizens of Tyre would become, according to verse 7, mourning, grieving, broken refugees. And God is saying, look, this place of prosperity, this place of, you know, not that it isn't following me is ultimately going to be wiped out. They would get wiped out by the Babylonians. Nebuchadnezzar would conquer Phoenicia in 572 BC. And ultimately, Alexander the Great, and then there would really not be a whole lot of profitable things that would come there after all of this destruction. And all that to say that even the pride of Tyre is mentioned in verse 9. Pride is a common theme throughout all of these 9 nations. We could say that pride really could be the subject matter we could have talked about the whole time, but they had pride. And I want to just say, as we overview this, as we see this 9th nation of Phoenicia, here's the thing that we need to understand. Real security doesn't come from wealth or military might. It comes from the Lord. And there's a way that we become sort of self-confident and we take things for granted when we think that military might and money keeps us safe. Those things are nice to have, but ultimately it's the Lord. And of course, this is something true, and I'll close with this thought. There was something I read that really shocked me, but it was something that one of the Soviet premiers said. His name was Nikita Khrushchev. He said this in 1956. He told a bunch of Western diplomats, you remember at the height of the Cold War, that wasn't the height of it, but that was kind of the beginning of it. Nikita Khrushchev told this to a whole bunch of Western diplomats, probably people from England and in America. He said, whether you like it or not, this is the Russian, if I had a good Russian accent, I would say it this way, but I can't. Whether or not you like it or not, history is on our side. We will bury you. Of course, Khrushchev died. The Soviet Union no longer exists. And his boastful prophecy never happened. And, you know, as you think about people that become confident in their wealth and in their military might, sometimes that doesn't equate to longevity. There's a lot of examples of that in cultures throughout human history. But ultimately, as we finish out these eight chapters, we've learned some important lessons. Number one, we know that the Lord is in control of the nations of the world. He's much bigger. He's the one we need to trust. He's eternal. I love that verse that tells us that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. We can always rely on Him. I mean, it's great that we have America, we have our Constitution, we have a very free society right now. It may not be that way in 10 or 20 years. But we always will have the Lord. And so God is in control. And one day Jesus is going to come back. And the Bible does say it's going to get worse before it gets better. But there's another lesson that we get as well, and that's that God does not take lightly the sin of pride. We have to pay attention to this. This is something that all woven throughout these prophecies, you see this. It's almost that God hates pride, and I think that there's a biblical precedence to say that, but God does not like pride in our lives. That's why the Bible says God resists the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. When nations turn from the living God and trust in their own wealth and their own armaments, their own military might, God almost a lot of the time has to show them that they don't have it as together as they think they do. And I think that's true personally, isn't it? You know, sometimes we can think that, I'm doing really good, everything's great, and then something breaks, and then we're like, oh no! And I think it's just better for us just to say thanks for everything, Lord, and if it blows up, so be it. God always, as well, gives us a word of promise and hope that even in the midst of God's discipline, there's hope. Even in the midst of God dealing with the nations, there was still hope. There was still a future. You know why? Because God isn't interested in just wiping us out. He wants to shake us up. And God was dealing with these nations because I think He had long outstretched arms at many times to these people, but they didn't listen. And so He had to allow things to happen in a certain way. And so God is greater than the nations. And as we've studied through this, I know it's a lot. We very rarely will cover this much on a Sunday morning. But it does sort of show us from high up how much God was serious about, you know, predicting things in human history and how powerful it was that Isaiah predicted this. Pay attention for a second. Everything that Isaiah said would happen, he said before it took place. All of this stuff about the nations, the Egyptians, the Edomites, the Moabites, he said before it ever happened. And guess what? Everything that he said before happened exactly like he said it would. And that's important to know. Why? Because when we get to chapter 24 through 27, we're talking about this little apocalypse or the little book of Revelation in Isaiah that tells us the future for us still. So if everything happened then, we can be very sure that all of those things will happen as well. And we find hope in the fact that God's already told us what's going to happen before it happens. And that's the Bible. And that's why we study it, because it gives us history in advance.